Welcome to another broadcast of Project Urantia on the Artist First Radio Network. An ever-growing number of people are thinking about the idea that maybe celestial beings have been influencing the history of Earth since there's been a history of Earth. And in my humble opinion, one person that knows about more about that, in my opinion, than anybody else out there, it's Michael in Maui. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Z-Man.
I was repeating myself there. Well, my, you are truly, in my estimation, the real deal. I believe, in my humble opinion, that the experiences that you had are absolutely genuine and real. And, of course, listeners, we invite you to listen and make up your own minds. Are we out of our freaking heads, or are we revealing something that the world needs to know? I think it's very important, but you guys make up your own minds. So, Michael, what's on the topics for today's broadcast?
Well, you know, what you're saying is absolutely true. Everybody has to make up their own mind, but you put all this story with feet right here on the ground, right here on Earth. It's not so, you know, out of this world. You make things actually quite understandable. But yet, the Celestials have and are still operational in terms of their influence. Presently, one of the functions that I have is being able to receive information that comes through many times in the form of visions. And some of these visions have already played out or are in the midst of playing out. So they're pretty much, I can say, they're pretty trustworthy if we properly interpret them. And this morning I had another vision, which was interesting because it didn't quite work the same way as I used to be able to, or actually I would be able to do. And there's a good reason for it, apparently. Now, one of the things that is functional is a type of vision that is considered morontio. Somewhere between the physical, functioning with my actual brain, some physical part of my brain, probably the pineal gland, and a spiritual source, and making that transition soul source, in which one of the things that I was prepared to receive and have been faithfully sending some of these messages. And one of them that I like to talk about is one that they gave out today, which was interesting. And what it amounted to was myself looking at very close up, as if with a magnifying glass, a type of stone. I thought it was to examine this stone. So I looked at it carefully. It seemed to have like a granite-like or basaltic-like structure. And then I said, well, I think I should back up a bit and see what this is about, because just looking at stone is no fun. So I began to look, zoom back, and so I couldn't zoom very far back, and I started to zoom back, and then I noticed a flat sort of Polynesian nose, you know, or kind of flat nose, you know. And I said, oh, that's interesting. It reminds me of something. I wonder what it is. So I began to look to the right and to the left, and I noticed above and to the side, you know, oh, it's a face. So I started to try to zoom back a little bit more, and I couldn't get the full face in view, so I began to scan around it in taking pieces of it, and I couldn't get back on it, I couldn't get back up on it to see the full face, and I wasn't sure why that was. Usually I can, you know, zoom in, zoom out, know, look right, look left, be very interactive. But the zooming back part didn't quite work. And then I said, well, this sure reminds me of those stone heads in Mexico, the Olmec struck. You know the Olmecs? You ever heard of them?
Certainly, yeah.
Those guys with that big, they carved these big stone heads, and they left them laying around there in Mexico. But apparently, after doing a little bit of research on the Olmecs, found out, yeah, that's probably what they were pointing me to, the Olmec head. And interestingly enough, the Olmecs were very old. and they probably prospered. 1200 to 400 before Common Era, BCE, before Common Era. So they're quite old. They predated the Maya for a very long time. And
let's tell the listeners that, in case you don't know what we're talking about, these things are about, I don't know, would you say they're about, first of all, they're very round. They look like giant bowling balls sitting in the jungle, but they're carved into heads, and they're about 6 feet tall, right?
At least that much. Probably some of them look like about 10 to 12 feet.
But they're almost spherical. Right. They would remind you, I mean, they started with what looks like, you know, a giant sphere stone and carved it in. So I just thought we'd interject that understand what you're talking about.
They had some purpose for that, but this isn't about the purpose for why they left that legacy there. But it was important. Well, let me tell you why they did it. Because they knew that stone would last a long time. And they had been one of the last schooled civilizations by some of these extraterrestrials. You might call them humanoid from another planet, maybe. Interestingly enough, they had some meeting areas in which they kind of like to copy those that they were interfacing with, and that was dug up a group of sculptures of apparently a meeting, and they placed these groups in this group of individuals, I guess perhaps a priesthood, and they all had what appears to have been that type of conic head. They carved out of stone these shapes, these individuals who had these conic heads. And they were the imitation type, in other words, the type that was made by banding the head of babies, I guess, and through a certain point in their life until they formed that conical shape. But that was an imitation of the very people that I interfaced with. There was a group of the scientific type. Riley calls them the Stagians. They, at the time, wore face masks. And when I shared air with them, essentially walked in the same corridor with them. And they had what appeared to be face masks. And later they took them off. And they allowed me to really, really take a good look at them. In fact, one of them, there were three of them that were showing me themselves and then actually doing some, I guess, some research on who I was. And they found the information. They were pleased. And the two of them left and one remained. And he knew that I was still looking at him. And I was in a shielded room, apparently. I could see out. And they didn't care for me, you know, watching me. They were busy at what they were doing. And he began to just stand there, give me a full face view of him. Then he turned like a mugshot. He turned sideways and gave me a perfect profile. And I stayed there for a long time so I could get a good look at the shape of their head, which is not like it was banded. It definitely was natural in shape. Had more of depth in the back of the head. In other words, it wasn't flattened out by being banded. It was still had a curve to the back of their head. Yet, when you looked at them face forward, take the dimension between chin to the middle of the forehead and double it. That's how high their heads were, in a conical shape. But their face, if you were to put a hat on them, they looked perfectly human. They had extremely long earlobes that extended below their chin line. Thick earlobes, however, not flat like many times you see in the Buddhist depictions of Buddha would have it, it's long, flat earlobes. But they had more more thicker earlobes that dropped into like a teardrop, but pretty heavy. I gave them the nickname the Elephant Man because while they had their face mask off, it looked like a trunks, and then the tall forehead. Well, the Olmecs apparently had interface with them, who gave them who taught them perhaps the earliest sciences concerning agriculture and the observation of the stars and cycles. And they are credited with some debate, the Olmecs, as the true developers of the long count calendar, which was later adopted by the Maya. So this long count calendar basically was to give the Olmec their timetable from in which they had a certain period in which they would have to uplift a civilization fully. Now, things happened and things changed. The Olmec culture fell because of probably earth changes that disrupted their agriculture. In other words, they had a lot of failed crops and the people just had to leave. And the civilization fell. But some of their knowledge persisted and it found its way back into culture. And probably the Mayan culture is the last remnants of it, somewhat distorted, however. And but the Olmec, the interesting part, which I discovered, was they were the original developers of that long count calendar, who probably received it from celestial agents who were there to teach. Now, this is something that has its basis in the way celestials tend to work in uplifting a planet. They do come in and teach the local fellows about sciences and agriculture and civilization and mathematics and things like that. In fact, they had a school here, in fact, two schools, and one of them was the known Eden, you know, like Adam and Eve in Eden, you know, the Garden of Eden. But the Garden of Eden was more than that. It was a literal school. Celestial agents were there. Been described as ones, some of these who had great authority. And then the school was closed, essentially, because of the concept of the cherubs who held these flaming swords. And said, sorry, school's out. It's over. So anyway, when that happened, it was probably around the time when the Olmec culture was just about peaking out, just starting up, of the old knowledge in which they had attained over time. But when I reflect back to why I couldn't zoom back on this vision of looking at this big Olmec head close up, was its association, the Olmec association with the long count calendar, and how the celestials would lead me to the true source of the long count calendar. And because I couldn't back up and wanted to need to know that that me looking at this Olmec head close up was in a sense telling me how close to the end of the long count we truly are. So there's a lot of substance, even coming from the celestial source, saying that this age is really, really, truly going to turn. And anything has to be looked at, there's the fall of the Olmec too, culture, who suffered probably under tremendous climatic as well as earth changes, disrupted maybe river flows, the way irrigation could no longer proceed, and they had to look for different, and maybe the climate changed pretty drastically, so they had to find someplace else. So they went into a fall, and some of the knowledge was kept, in fact, a good amount of it, and then later found its way back out into the later civilizations that developed the fallen civilizations, like the Olmec.
Well, you know, when you're trying to provide an explanation as to how the Mayans were able to even know a galaxy existed, because of the where you are, it's hard to determine that. They were able to measure the to within a ridiculous preciseness the distance across the galaxy. They knew all these things that we're supposed to believe that they just figured it out with some sticks and some scratching in the mud.
Yeah.
Well, it's okay, maybe that happened, but to me, a much more plausible explanation is someone told them about it.
Right, exactly. And it happens that they got it from someone else who got someone to a more direct influence from. So the Mayans actually learned it secondhand through traditions, and some of it got distorted. However, the Longkhor calendar remained pretty much intact. So that's an interesting point in which the Celestials wanted me to at least share this knowledge with everyone, that the Mayans is really not the source of it, yet the source of it is them, but I'm, as the Celestial agents, they're the source of it, but it's been passed down through the line, and using their way of getting my attention was to point me at least to the culture of the Olmecs, and to say that we're pretty darn close. I mean, at the point in which you're looking at it, the end with a magnifying glass, we're that right up to the end already. So it's pretty poignant in the sense of that vision.
Well, let's for a moment entertain the idea that something unimaginably horrible is going to happen in 10 months. And it will be so cataclysmic that game over as far as everything's concerned. Just for a moment. Okay, let's say that's going to happen. We don't know it yet. Maybe there's a planet Nibiru's going to fly by and cause all these things. Maybe whatever. Call it what you will. Is there anything any of us can really do about that? I mean, can you buy – will the guy who buys the million-dollar apartment in the missile silo, you know, out in the Midwest somewhere, is he going to survive? And is there really anything – anyone can do except hope that you fall between the cracks?
Well, yeah, there's those people, then they'll probably survive. In fact, there's going to be a lot of survivors. However, there will be a lot of people that would suffer under the fall of a civilization. And when a civilization falls, people disperse. And this is another point in which they wanted me to remember, at least to get an idea. We have enough good archaeologists, anthropologists that have studied the culture of fallen civilizations and what happens to people. And they just disperse. There's a lot of immediate fighting, things that cause end of a civilization, and one of them is the lack of unity. And people who are in missile silos would eventually have to come out. And if civilization there's no order there, well, they may not persist. Well, in the case of where we're headed for, I don't think that we are looking into a lost civilization, a lost planet Earth. In a case like that, there would be a very important move that the Celestials have prepared and are prepared to accomplish if necessary. And that would be evacuating as many as they can who are ready or under their choice selection process ready. And they consider them able to be saved, worth saving. And the number is not very large, but enough to restart somewhere else. So that would mean this place would be pretty much fried. However, if it doesn't come to that, and it comes to a point where there is a point in which it's you can salvage a lot of a civilization, it will be rebuilt in a way that is much better, and one in which understands the problems of the past. So essentially, it cannot be broken down so bad that there's no memory of the past, much like how the Olmecs were able to pass on the wisdom of the priesthood who held this type of education that the Celestials directly gave and taught in a literal school, a real school, and passed it on to the point in which another culture could rebuild and use some of their knowledge. And we have an example of the Mayans. So in this case, we're looking toward perhaps a similar type event, but one in which is perhaps more salvageable because of our abilities to continue our technologies and our ability to remain in communication through other forms of communications which the Olmecs did not have. Communication, of course, is essential to the rebuilding of civilization. Without it, there is just broken up groups, fragments, and there'd be a lot of suspicion and fear generated. So,
well, and what about the time factor?
Yeah.
If you can't get immediately started on rebuilding your civilization, as I've always been suspicious of this, I think other historians have as well. If, for instance, if Atlantis really existed, but it existed, say, 30,000 years ago, as some speculate maybe it has, a civilization that was obliterated by whatever its end was 30,000 years ago, and, you know, that 20,000 years, 25,000 years passes before modern civilization rebuilds itself, what is there going to be left to find? You know, outside of things like the pyramids and other massive stone structures, everything is obliterated and buried. So if you don't get your civilization going in short order, just the length of time between the previous one and the next one can ensure it's not going to happen.
Yes, exactly. And this is one of the things that I was wondering about. And what I received back was an answer that the time periods that we are looking at as short and immediate are too short sometimes, too sudden. There's actually a rollover which may take years, not days. And there is also another factor in which long periods are actually much shorter. There can be strength that for rebuilding a civilization, the shorter periods, again, are due to fact that we will have technology still available to us that will allow it to be shortened, the rebuilding process. So this is another point in which was made to me, and at least I could understand. Besides the point that at that same point, there will still be a lift. There will still be a very large number of people that will be removed and probably taken to the New Jerusalem, that grand mothership or the grand city that is orbiting Saturn presently. Because there's a grand school there, a huge school there. And with many of the same type of teachers that people try to admit, literally even trying to shape their heads to look like them. And they will be there again to reinstall true teachings and the true universe citizenship, and as well as its method of function beyond what we have today. Today we've been actually fooled into thinking that the purpose of life is to get rich and to build profitable companies, and that's all there is to life. That's totally wrong. The picture will immensely change under their tutelage.
On the topic of the elongated skull, boy, there's just so many examples of that throughout history. I'm thinking of a couple of the Egyptian pharaohs had really, you know, distorted skulls. You know, the South American cultures that have tried to, you know, my goodness, what that must be very painful to shape your skull into that You know, for what reason? Why would you make a child or a person suffer for decades to get that shape of the head? You know, they have to be mimicking what they saw. On the last show, on the previous show before this one, is a great example. On Bigfoot Central, they showed a Native American tribe that was photographed in the late 1800s, and they had elongated skulls. American Indians, a certain tribe had. You know, it just makes you wonder. I mean, it's sometimes the obvious answer is the right answer. They're imitating these celestial beings.
Exactly, and that's exactly what is easy to happen. Of course, there's also ways in which the celestials would cover their appearance, very similar to how Spock in Star Trek would use that ski hat or that skull cap to cover his ears. You know, different types of hats. And there are many, many types of hats that the priests had in particular that were tall, very tall, so that could cover the tops of some guy who looked perfectly normal as a human being, as long as he didn't notice that he had a very, very tall conical head. So these things happened.
What's the percentage that common knowledge thinks that of the, what percentage of DNA do we actually use, or what percentage am I asking that correctly? Like, for instance, people say, well, we only use 10% of our brain. Is there like dummy DNA in our bodies that, you know, we don't seem to have any use for?
Yes, there's that seemingly that area in which is considered, I don't know what this for, junk DNA. It's because we haven't yet realized the resonant part of our makeup in terms of celestial resonance. Much of what I and how I receive my knowledge is not able to be documented in science. I mean, it's really, some people, it's a new science, a neoscience, a type in which the beginning to try to find ways in which such transmission could be made possible, but a lot of it has to do with activation of DNA. Because some of our DNA have like time triggers in them. You know, what changes a person from a little child goes through puberty, that natural change, what triggers that, what turns that on? You know, a human being, oh, I think I'm going to be a kid, it's wonderful being a kid, all of a sudden things change. Darn, I'm growing up, right? Well, I'm not going to be a kid no more. And you have a whole different attitude, different ideas, different emotions, all that being generated by time clocks within the DNA itself. These things also find themselves with triggers into our own higher selves, which generally find their operation opening into a realm which is, by the Urantia books, description and the terminology, Marantia. Marantia is a bridge between truly spiritual and truly physical. And our soul essentially fits in between there, fits within that position. And one of the characteristics of material, Marantia material, is that much of the technology that operates with the celestials is Marantia material. And I was able to see at least a plant-like that was glowing and beautiful and wonderful that, you know, was described by Moses as a bush that burned and was not consumed. This is Marantia material. It's living, but it's special. It's not spirit, and it's not solid physical. Yet it interacts with both very, very lively in a very living way. So this type of character begins to be turned on as we head toward that. There are people who already have, such as myself, have various triggers turned on. So more and more of the civilization, more and more people will get turned on as they actually have to choose to allow that to happen. And when it they make that choice, that kind of a choice, it happens. So more, much like a normal process. It can be resisted, though, because you can feel it coming on.
Well, I don't know. I guess bliss, ignorance is bliss at the moment. I mean, if there is some dark dwarf star that comes through our solar system every 30,000 years or so, that's going to pass close by the planet, it's going to cause tremendous devastation. What are you going to do about it anyway? I mean, honestly, I live in a house that's 80 years old, and if there's 200-mile-an-hour winds, my house will be blown away, and it will no longer exist. You know, I just wonder, in a practical sense, sometimes, you know, if the government did know that we were all going to be obliterated in December, would they tell us? I don't think so. What do you think?
I don't think they would, because the destabilization of such a terrifying knowledge would probably be much too hard for people. Would just end up quitting their jobs and society would stop. Why continue, you know, doing the 9-to-5 rut and why so do something that, you know, fills you? Well, in a sense, this is pretty much the message. And the one in which the Celestials want me to bring people's awareness to is the construct of the soul. In other words, people go through their life. This is one of the biggest complaints I had, and one of the reasons I cried out to God was this conveyor belt of life. Essentially, you get born, you live through life, and you die. Is that all there is to life? What's going on? It just seems like a totally redundant, meaningless process. Well, later on, I found out through the Celestials themselves, who gave me insight on that. Purpose was to build this Morancho soul of ours between ourselves and divinity, which breathes into us life and excites and ignites some of the DNA which within us, which makes even more that structure of a matured soul, a soul that is full of real life experience and real wisdom and real correct choices, and really operating in as expressions of the will of the first source and center. And this is what has allowed many to proceed through their life and build successfully enriched souls. And to be totally ignorant of that and just say, just get rich and do this or whatever, do what you want, and you only go around once in life, and have a total ignorance on what you need to do, and that enrichment of the soul between oneself and the first source and center would make a life project. In other words, you're building the wrong thing in life. Listen, you're supposed to be over there working, and you're over here working, and you're doing nothing that's going to make the difference. And this is the greatest gift that I was given was, yes, it's not an assembly line. It's a conveyor belt of life. Gives you a point in time in which to start gaining basic sentience, intelligence, education, a mind that is critical in thinking, one that a receptivity to divine sources, spiritual insight, and operation at levels of power that are beyond your physical manipulations, extending sensory abilities past your five senses, sixth and seventh and eighth, moving on. And these things can be applied and developed while you're alive physically. And if you just simply go about and wonder what, you know, just keep the old project going, just keep the old body going, well then not, and then trying to just use life as a point of, you know, pleasure seeking, nothing gets built that is of any worth. And this is what the Celestials look at. They're able to look into a person and see, what is this person's worth? I see nothing. I see void. Yet they look into others and see. These are the things that they knew about when I cried out in the backyard. And Tan came forth, Tan and Nella came forth, picked me up, and went on. And by the way, Tan especially, was able to at least vocalize his concern on everything that's happening right now, mentioning the nuclear power plants that were unstable, that would later fail, caused disruptions in our lives, a financial system that was corrupt. All of these things he saw years ago, and volunteered to actively help us gain an understanding that they're there, they understand, but we've got to choose to start to at least operate in a way that they do, and that requires moving beyond the 9-to-5 job, the concept of attaining material things and stuff, and financial, but building this morontial self, the one that is able to be translated and given eternal life, essentially go through that process of having something. Otherwise, you'd be basically a long-lived animal. Maybe one smart one, and that's not what they want to. That's not what they're coming for. That's not what this life is about.
Michael, is there a distinction between the soul and what people call a spirit? Is that an interchangeable term, or are those two separate things?
They're very distinct and separate. Spirit is classified in various senses. Essentially, you know, there's spirit, that the spirit of life. You wonder, we can get all of the elements together, maybe rudimentary assembly products that may form protein strings that might end up becoming something like life. But actually, there's a spirit of life which ignites that and organizes it, which is very, very dynamic. Is a spirit of intellect and intuition, which gives our minds something special, a thought that is above the animal. You ever wonder, those with bigger brains than us, why don't they develop? Whales and elephants, who actually have a fabulous features about their brain, because they weren't given that receptivity to certain other higher spiritual interfaces, to different spirits. There are actually 7 spirits that proceed from the first source. And when it comes to the soul, that is something that is possessed by us humans on this planet Earth. But we also share spiritual insight and affinities to, like, an animal, which has a sort of spiritual thing too. And they can, you know, certain pets, they feel emotions, besides the physical things like pain and touch that's pleasurable and nice. They don't have that building platform that is able to translate these spiritual as well as physical elements into a vehicle that can go through transplantation into essentially continued realm. The soul itself can get parked and can go to sleep. The spirit continues. It just continues on. And many times it can be absorbed, but other times it is reflective. It just goes until it's dissipated. As much similar as energy, you could say, like a radio broadcast is a type of a spirit. It just, once propagated, it continues on. Even if it passes, it's still going on. The electromagnetic force. A spirit has many affinities that are very similar to, if not exactly like, electrical force. So, but the soul is more like a hard drive, perhaps. Write a lot of things into it and reassemble the reality of knowledge with everything, every element. That's not possessed by an animal. That spirit is common to all life.
I can't help feeling sorry for some of the brightest minds in the world out there in science who absolutely cannot merge science with some of the topics we talk about. It's like it has to be one way or the other. There is only, you know, laws of nature and laws of physics, and then, you know, if I can't explain it, it therefore cannot exist. Or recent program I saw Stephen Hawking on, he arrogantly declares there is no God, and here's why. And I would say to Mr. Hawking, all due respect, sir, we probably as a species know less about physics than we know. In other words, we've yet to discover most things, yet you're able to draw a conclusion based on this little fraction of knowledge you've gained in your lifetime, and there's so much more to learn. I just, again, it's the typical arrogance of the humans. We know it all, right?
Well, it's a point of where we want to become comfortable in. It's a comfort zone, you might say, in taking comfort in our intelligence and our intellect. But that's also a spiritual gift. It's a part of a way of arranging our knowledge base and how our minds can get, our brain actually, as well as the mind. The mind is a spiritual influence too. The common mind, the mind sharing, was another thing that was open to me when I was able to manipulate one of the celestial's arms and feel his head and things like that. And then how they actually speak, we mind share, and they can become present on this show because of a mind sharing. That's a type of a spiritual connect. But I'll never forget the look on the face of this guy who dared me to go out in the backyard, and said, God does not exist. Why don't you go out one night in the backyard and scream out to God that if he's real and he's all-powerful, then he'll show himself, well, or he'll do something. And I said, well, okay. And I had enough conviction to go out and do that. And, well, later I did kind of have a memory of a beautiful star that came out of place and went into the back. And the rest of it was blanked out, but I remember this beautiful star that came out of heaven and sit in my backyard. And I met him, and I told him, you know, I did that, and guess what happened? And I told him with such conviction, and with a type of, must be a type of, I guess, spiritual energy, that his face turned white and he ran away. I never saw him again.
Now, did he tell you that in a supportive way, or did he say, oh, why don't you go out and scream up into heaven and see what happens? Was he mocking you in a way?
He was saying he was actually agnostic. He didn't know such a thing could be done, but he wasn't willing to do it himself because I didn't think he was willing to sit with an answer. And then when I came with an answer, which basically confirmed that reality, that God does exist, knocked his socks off, basically.
Well, think about the coincidence that just, and we know it now, it's not a coincidence, but the fact that at the instant you decided to try this, Tan was within range. You know, what are the odds in that? When it's 4 light years away where they live, he had to be fairly close by, didn't he?
Yeah, he was. Perhaps very close by. They have been frequenting this area, and more than Riley and myself, or Nancy Leader. There's been others, many others, but not every one of us have been invited, or actually taken on, and then surprised because it didn't turn out the way some people want. They can get terrified, as you can imagine. So not everybody comes back with this kind of open knowledge. But I was prepared for this as part of their volunteering to help continue that program, because we've got to move past that point in which the faith and philosophy, and then you have science and that intellect of science opposing each other. There is presently, it appears very close, especially when I listen to people like Michio Okaku, that there's coming a very closeness to the two, and it soon will be emerging when great knowledge does come through, a real revelatory excitement will happen in the human race as that begins to come forth. And that discovery is something that I believe will become really a big change in how we do things.
I hope this isn't terrible to say this, but I wonder if Stephen Hawking's opinion of the existence of God is based on his situation in life. How could a loving God do this to me? I mean, he's a remarkable feat of health, or not in that fashion, but anyone else would have died years ago. And there's really not much explanation as to how he's able, through his sheer mind, to stay alive in his condition. And, of course, we'll pray for you, Stephen, and I'm not saying that in jest. But the arrogance of science, I mean, Michio Kaku, for instance, he was instrumental in string theory development, I believe, and we still have membrane theory and this theory and that theory. We don't have any idea about a lot of physics. So how in the world can we be drawing conclusions of finite things like, oh, okay, you guys, I figured it all out. Everybody go home. There is no God. Quit fooling around.
Yeah.
Come on. You know, all right, well, so I won't stay on that topic, getting back to Tan and you crying out in your backyard, you know, is there a God? Show yourself. And poof, Tan shows up. To remind listeners, you have recollections in your childhood of visitations, don't you?
Oh, myself?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
And, of course, they knew about you because they had been watching you. So it's not just wasn't a sheer...
Actually, before I even was born.
There you go. Well, I just wanted to make that connection so listeners didn't think that this was an unrealistic thing that Tan, someone who lives four light years away, happened to be in your backyard when you went outside. It makes perfect sense when you follow the whole story. One day, we're going to have to try to do a recap story. We have done, I believe, over 150 or 160 shows, and there's so much information there. For someone that's just joining the program or hearing about it for the first time, they have a lot of catching up to do. And maybe we could do a program where we sort of try and touch on the highlights, you know, an outline of what the show's about and the higher points, and give a person maybe a starting point who's a new listener. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, well, there's another podcast that I'm doing. Could I mention it?
Absolutely.
It ends up... brand new, fairly new. It's not with Curtis Cooperman in Hello Earth. It's I mentioned them once before. It's called Broadcast Urantia. Broadcast Urantia. It just started a podcast, which is doing exactly that. And it's basically a monologue. It's not as nowhere near as lively as working with Z-Man here. It's just almost like me just telling a story, monotone and a monologue, and basically telling that story. Whereas the stuff that I had on Hello Earth and have on Hello Earth is more educational. And but you could go there too to receive that type of information. And I'd still be very happy to tell the same story. You know.
No, I don't think. I think that's a great tool. By the way, we can hear birds in the background. You are so lucky where you live. It's like 1 degree outside the station here, and I can hear. Yeah, that's. You live in paradise, truly. But no, I think that's great. Again, we're here to get the information out. If that's another way to get over there, we'll be happy to continue to tell folks about that show.
An interesting part about it is that the classification of people like myself are considered part of the reserve corps of destiny under the Destiny Guardians guidance. Those people that I promised to help are the Destiny Guardians. And they are extremely powerful in terms of their abilities to influence, to broadcast good thoughts, to try to steer humanity right. But we who have been prepared by them have a title called the Reserve Corps of Destiny. But there are many who, perhaps even like yourself, Z-Man, don't really know that you're a part of this Reserve Corps. apparently you were prepared by a very special agent that came at a very early age into your life. You don't know how many more things happened. But ultimately, it's to preserve truth rather than have truth, you know, stomped out by, like, say, science. This is the intent of this other podcast. It's called, again, broadcasturansha.com. And that's its intent. So there are many out there. And as the awakening begins to happen, this reserve corps will begin to awaken. And we meet many more voices out there for the same program and saying nearly the same things, maybe in a little different way, using different words. And especially interesting is different languages. Yeah.
Ah. Yeah, for a transcript of tonight's show, write down everything we said. Okay, I'm joking. Yeah, that may be the next thing. Maybe somebody will come up with software that I'm sure they have it already that could give you a written transcript. And there's those birds again. Dadgummit. Yeah, I did want to bring one thing up, and we're almost out of time. You did mention before that not everybody who's had the same experience you have had was able to handle it mentally and found it to be a pleasurable thing. And I just wanted to say that shortly after we began broadcasting with you, I received a call from a gentleman. I don't even remember his name right now. But we spoke for maybe 45 minutes, and he wanted me to know that he was on the craft with Nancy, he was on there with you, and that he just wanted to tell me that everything you were saying was true. And I said, well, why don't you join us? Why don't you come on a program? And he said, you know, this was not a pleasant thing for him. It's nothing he wants to go on the air and talk about. He's glad you're doing it, but it has not been a... And I don't remember his exact words, but it seemed like this was a burden on his life, and it didn't go as well as it did with you.
And that's true. It was for me, essentially, before I would allow full operation. You can progressively allow yourself to come into alignment, and it's all right. So, it may take time for that to blossom. You don't expect a bud to bloom immediately. It happens over time.
Well, Michael, we are out of time for tonight's broadcast, except for the fact I need to say the following statements. Michael does this program because he told his celestial friends that he would do this and he would help spread the word, which is why he does Hello Earth and broadcasturansha.com. We have nothing to sell on this broadcast. Michael does not get paid, and Artist First loses money on every single show due to the cost of producing and distributing it to hundreds of thousands of people. How cool is that? And Michael, on behalf of all of our listeners, we thank you very much for doing this broadcast and spending this time with us every week.
You're certainly welcome. Celestials themselves are empowering this broadcast more and more.
Well, our numbers keep going up, folks. That's right. We can actually count the number of people that download this show. And I'll look that up and get back to you. It's in the millions now. It's ridiculous, folks. And it's all because of you out there. You love us or hate us. Tell your friends if you love us. Tell your friends if you hate us. Tell your enemies. But tell folks about the broadcast and let them know we're here, and make up your own mind. Michael, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Okay. Aloha.